This is our second and final session on Holocaust, Jewish story, Christian story. I'm delighted to see you back, those of you who made it, and I think that I would like briefly to summarize what we did last night, or tried to do. We sort of stopped right in midstream, and then pick it up from there and turn to some of the narrative response, a different kind of response to Holocaust. If I were to summarize, what we were trying to experience last night was some appreciation, some growing awareness of Holocaust, namely the 6 million, approximately 6 million Jews and about 5 million non-Jewish people who were in various ways exterminated, killed during the Nazi era, particularly under the Nazi aegis, though not exclusively. And we wanted to look at this as a unique event and ask the question, how could it happen? Well, I think the most obvious first thing that one thinks about here in terms of responsibility would be the Nazi regime itself. And I think it deserves underscoring that that regime was profoundly anti-Semitic, and secondly, that it was a pagan anti-Semitism. It was a deeply non-Christian anti-Semitism. We didn't spend a lot of time on that. I kind of assumed that. And then we looked at two other factors which helped complicate the matter for us, I think. One is the whole Berkowitz calls the acquiescence of the West. And there we looked at the apathy of the surrounding Western European and American governments, which is a painful part of the indictment, that we not only were quiet and not very responsive in terms of protest, but at certain times we even failed to help where we might have helped. And of course, one other thing that I'm not sure if I mentioned it or not, but it certainly deserved mention, that despite pleas from various sources that the railroads leading out of the concentration camps be bombed, or the camps themselves be bombed to stop the death, the burning of the people in the gas chambers and so on, killing of them in the gas chambers and burning of them, this never was done. And the reasons were given were primarily military and perhaps political. So the second thing which it was problematic was the official attitude of Christianity, and we looked at that a little bit. And I think at the heart of the difficulty is perhaps something closest to us, and that is the maybe pervasive, latent anti-Semitism that may even be present in our Christian documents and certainly has been present through the centuries of the Christian church. And all of this adds up to our raising the issue anew today, telling the story once again to ourselves and thinking about it. Why raise the issue now? I think one thing we might say is the event that happened 40 years ago, roughly, has indeed in some ways been paradigmatic, and in a frightening way, in a sense, prophetic of all sorts of other Holocausts, whether they are in Cambodia or whether they're in Uganda or elsewhere in our world. And people have come up to me after the sessions and have said, did you realize such and such and so and so? Someone said to me, what about the 400,000 gypsies who were killed by the Germans? And I said, yes, I knew about them. And what about some others that I'd not even heard about? So there's an enormous amount of fundamental violation of the sanctity of human life going on in our globe. And somehow that should involve us simply as a human family. Okay, and then I think closer to that, we as Christians who in some way want to think through our Christian faith, and some of us, many of us are Lutheran Christians, And perhaps even German Lutheran Christians have maybe a special investment in this whole experience. I'd like to quote to you from Mark Tannenbaum, if I can dig this quote out here, who is the director of the Interracial Affairs Committee of the American Jewish Committee. His concern is one I think that I share because it hits me squarely in the face too. He makes the following statement: the erosion of belief in the sanctity of human life is one of the decisive black legacies bequeathed by Nazi Germany to mankind. By and large, with rare exception, the overwhelming majority of citizens of the Western world and their dominant institutions have avoided confronting the magnitude of evil incarnate in the Nazi Holocaust, and have therefore failed to learn how to cope with forces and structures of dehumanization that are being replicated in many parts of the globe. Do you agree with that? You know, that we have personally and institutionally really failed to come to grips with the Holocaust experience. That's kind of where I'd hoped we would have left off the discussion yesterday, and then the bell rang and we stopped, and that kind of was the end. And I had raised an interpretive problem as well, namely how one might view the whole Holocaust in assessing it totally. And as you know, one radical theologian in the Jewish camp, Richard Rubinstein, after Auschwitz, has come to the conclusion, finally, that it would be an obscenity to continue to believe in God after that. That's his conclusion. Ironically, part of his conclusion comes in response to another interpretation given by a man by the name of Dean Heinrich Gruber, which, if I say it very briefly, will shock you, but he said it much more sophisticatedly, namely that it is part of the way God's wrath works out in human history. And as the Jews were punished by the Babylonians way back in the Old Testament, and then later on God punished the Babylonians with the Persians, so the Jews suffered at the hands of the Nazis, and to be sure, now we Germans are suffering the consequences of our sins. Who was this Heinrich Gruber? Was he a kind of an anti-Semitic German kook? No. He helped protect Jews. He helped get Jews out of Germany. He risked his life to save Jewish people. And this encounter happened in a very intimate personal conversation. And at one point when Rubinstein confronted him with a question, Gruber, in a deep Christian piety, says, well, the only way I can come to terms with this is by looking at the Old Testament. And I see that that's the way God works in human events. And that, Rubinstein, may not be too fair, but Rubinstein uses that as the coup de grace on the basis of which he finally says, I could no longer believe in a God who would do that to his people. And then he admits, he says, of course, I didn't have a chance to ask Gruber what the sins were for which these 6 million peoples were being punished. Whereas in the Old Testament, I think there's a long history of apostasy and so on, which led to the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, and my closing question was, is there an alternative interpretation to these two, that one must finally say God is dead, if that could happen, and if it's happening around our globe today, or that this is part of the retributive, what's the word I want, retributive justice of God in carrying out his wrath on sinful mankind? Well, we don't have time to explore this whole thing theologically, but I think our own scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures above all, provides us with the person of Job, who asks, why has this happened? And he does not get an answer. And finally, there is no answer, but God addresses him. God gets back in touch with him. And then Job, in a new relationship to God, comes to a trust in God in spite of events. Now that may be a way in which one can find a third alternative. There may be still another, but I want to get to that later, if I hope we have time, after we've looked at some of the response to Holocaust, which is given to us by people who actually experienced it. You see, it's a little bit too easy to come to Job right away. As one writer has put it, we're all only Job's sisters and brothers. We haven't been there. But Elie Wiesel has been there. And where is she, my dear Corrie ten Boom? Corrie ten Boom has been there. They experienced the death camps. They almost died themselves. They barely got out alive through the armed forces rescuing the troops in the one case of Elie Wiesel. And I forget exactly how Corrie ten Boom got out. That's right. It was a clerical error. Yeah, I knew there was something fluky about it. Yeah. So I think what we will do is take a look at these, and then I have one other book I'd like to look at briefly, and then perhaps after a bit we can open the whole thing up for a little bit of discussion. First of all, just a word about Corrie ten Boom. Most of you have probably read the book or may have, in fact, seen the movie. And so you probably have a little bit more of a feel of the story. As you know, then, Corrie was a daughter, a spinster daughter, together with her sister Betsy, of a very marvelous patrician watchmaker in, I think, Harlem, Holland, who, when the Nazis began to move in, found themselves helping Jews escape, sending messages, and they soon became a center of the underground. For the women, it was first a very exciting adventure, but very soon matters got more tense, and they built a secret room in one of the upstairs buildings where people could hide in case of an emergency, and they practiced this and so on. Finally, of course, someone squealed on them, and they were apprehended and taken to the concentration camp. Interestingly enough, all of the Jews who at that time were harbored in that little hiding place survived. Corrie's father did not survive. He died, he was an old man, and Corrie's sister Betsy finally died too in the camp. And as you helped me out, Betsy herself got out by a fluke. She is, I think, still alive. Corrie is still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah. She suffered a stroke, and so her activities are very curtailed. Many of you may have heard her speak, and you knew that her personal piety really communicates itself with an amazing love. I want to come back to that story again a little later, but just to review it for you, and we will discuss it a little bit more fully later on. I'd like rather now to spend more time on Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel is currently teaching at, I think, Boston University, is in America now. He was born in 1928 in Hungary, and as a young boy was taken into a concentration camp, first Auschwitz, after which the whole Holocaust has somehow become named, which is only one of a whole system of camps. It was one of the six major death camps. And then he, after a while, because Auschwitz is in the eastern area of Europe, as the Russians were moving in, they had to move west. And he finally ends up in Buchenwald, and there barely survives. The story is a deeply moving story because it's undertold. It's told very modestly, and it's told with a certain amount of grim humor, very low-keyed, but terribly truthful about the way a little boy experiences the events. And basically what happens is that the family is quickly stripped of everything. They're stripped of their home, they're stripped of their furniture. Pretty soon they're just down to one little bag that they can carry, and then gradually more and more is stripped away. One of the kind of grimly humorous stories is how he has a gold tooth, and he haggles for that, and finally it's taken away from him by force. So when people start going after the gold in your mouth, you know things are really bad. But it isn't just that you're stripped of all your possessions, he's stripped of his family. One of the very moving moments in the book is where his mother and his sister are taken off
they always have these separations, and those are dreadful because you know the people who are separated off are not going to make it. And he is separated from his mother and his sister, and his father holds his hand, and he looks across in the distance and sees a smoke coming out of the ovens. And then at that point, this boy, who was such a profoundly pious child, he had always studied the Bible and studied the teachings and the Talmud and had a favorite rabbi, and he was just waiting for the Messiah to come. This was his dream. And he and the whole family, of course, are shattered by this, but it's, I think, one of the most moving things of the story is how his own faith, his childlike faith, goes up literally in smoke. And at one point, then, when he sees that and the family wants to pray, as many of the people did at this time, he says, "Never shall I forget that night, that first night in camp, which has turned my life into a long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget that nocturnal silence which deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I'm condemned to live as long as God himself. Never." As you hear the agony of a soul, and he is eloquent in putting it into simple words which really communicate in a way that all the talk that I was saying before doesn't begin to touch. There are some very touching moments in the story, too. There are moments of humanity and moments of light. One time he thanks God for the mud. The place is always a mess. But the people who were in charge kept taking everything they had, and one last thing he had was a nice pair of boots, which he had gotten from someone else, and they were new boots. They didn't fit, but they were new boots. But he was standing knee-deep in mud, and I think because the boots were so muddy, they weren't taken from him. And that was one time where, even though he is no longer believing in God, he said, "Thank God for the mud." Okay, now let's see. I have one other little incident which I'd like to share with you. I think another, just a general comment before I get to that, another moving part of the story is the odyssey that he takes as he watches his own father's martyrdom, you might say, and agony, and finally death. His father really lives for that boy and just spends himself, all the energy that he has, he gives in keeping the boy going, keeping him courageous, keeping him running, keeping him in food. And one time he sees his father just hit across the face with a heavy blow by one of the men there, and he himself is horrified that he doesn't move to protect his father. And he says, "I'll never forget that feeling." That's one of the places where he cries out that he will never forgive them for that. "I will never forgive them." Well, in that camp where he says things are a little better, one of the persons who was in charge of them, a young Pole, gave them a little speech about how things were at camp. And here's the speech that you get. "Comrades, you're in a concentration camp of Auschwitz. There's a long road of suffering ahead of you, but don't lose courage." But he really means it. I hear you laughing because you sound so ironic, but he meant it well. So I have to go on with that little interruption. "You've already escaped the gravest danger, selection, so now muster your strength and don't lose heart. We shall all see the day of liberation. Have faith in life. Above all else, have faith. Drive out despair, and you will keep death away from yourself. Hell is not for eternity. And now, a prayer, or rather a piece of advice, let there be comradeship among you. We're all brothers, and we're all suffering the same fate. The same smoke floats over all our heads. Help one another. It is the only way to survive. Enough said. You're tired. Listen. You're in Block 17. I'm responsible for keeping order here. Anyone with a complaint against anyone else can come and see me. That's all. You can go to your beds. Two people to a bunk. Good night." Quote, end quote. Lord Elie Wiesel says, the first human words. what's ironic about this, as so many moments of light in this utter darkness, is that it wasn't long before this man was removed because he was too soft on his people. Now, if I may go on to another moment, which is kind of interesting, because I mentioned Job earlier, at one point where some of the other people are singing Hasidic melodies, and others are talking of God and of his mysterious ways, and some are talking of the sins of the Jewish people and of their future deliverance, Eli says, "I had ceased to pray. How I sympathize with Job! I did not deny God's existence, but I doubted his absolute justice." In chapter 4, he describes a good camp, as he calls it, Buna, and in some ways it was a very good camp. They had more food there, and things were a little better. But toward the end, there are some brutalities, and somehow the Nazis must control things more. They seem to be losing control. And so one man, for a minor infraction, namely the stealing of some food, is hung up before all the people. They're not told what's happened, though, and there's, I don't know how many thousand in this little courtyard, and they all have to take their caps off and wonder what's going on, and then they march in this man, and he is hanged, and his last words are, "Long live liberty, a curse upon Germany, a curse," and that's the end. And then at the end of that chapter comes one that's really significant for our reflection, as well as very moving in the story, as part of the odyssey of his own, the agonizing death of his own inner faith and belief in God. He tells a story of a young child with a beautiful face who was the servant of a Dutch kapo, Oberkapo, in charge of the camp at that time. And he was apparently a liked person, and so of course he didn't last long. And what happened was there was an electric power station and it was sabotaged, and they somehow led a trail of evidence to this Dutch Oberkapo, and he was soon moved out to the east to another concentration camp, back to Auschwitz. They never heard of him, but the little servant boy was left behind. They put him to torture to try to find out who did the sabotaging, but he never spoke. And so then the following day, a gallows, three gallows in fact, were lifted up, and he was brought in and was one of the three who was then hung. Generally, they don't weep. They just stand mutely and numbly before what happens. The two adults cried out, he says, "Long live liberty," but the child was silent. And then someone behind him cries, "Where is God? Where is he?" And then the trouble is the child is so light that he can't die. I mean, his neck doesn't break because of the weight, so he hangs there kind of dangling and is going through slow agony. And he describes that briefly, but in agonizing specifics. And then he hears that same question again behind him. And Eli says, "I heard a voice inside of me answer him, 'Where is he?' 'He is here. He is hanging there on this gallows.'" I guess that's very moving because that expresses so vividly why, for the little boy who tells his story, as it were, God has died. Then in the next chapter, they're celebrating Rosh Hashanah, the last day of that accursed year, as he calls it. There's a way in which that grim humor comes through. And some people are ready to celebrate in prayer and in blessing God's name, but Eli asks, "How can I bless him, he who has created Auschwitz and all these other death factories?" So he wrestles through with this agony of belief. How can we bless God? Some of the people are, however, arguing, as the pious Jewish people did in the camps, what God's will is for them in a given instance. Should they fast or shouldn't they fast? They're all so emaciated they can barely make it through the day. And now the question comes up, should they fast? And many of them argue that they should. because this is a way, in spite of everything else, of still acknowledging that God is here, even in this enclosed hell. And as one of them put it, we would then be capable of singing his praises. Now, this is interesting because our theme for this summer is singing the Lord's song. And here they're singing the Lord's song by fasting on Rosh Hashanah out there in the death camp. But Eli says, I did not fast, mainly to please my father, who had forbidden me to do so. But further, there was no longer any reason why I should fast. I no longer accepted God's silence. As I swallowed my bowl of soup, I saw in that gesture an act of rebellion and protest against him. And I nibbled my crust of bread. In the depths of my heart, I felt a great void. What I jotted in my margin here the last time I read this, he's not too good at rebellion. Okay, well, the story goes on, and you have to read it for yourself. Things get worse and worse as they go across the country. There's an impossible trek through, I think, 30 miles of no man's land, snow, their feet wrapped in rags, and people are dying left and right. And there's one interesting moment where Eli talks with a rabbi whom he really loves. And the rabbi is the one person who has been encouraging other people to keep hope and not to despair. And every once in a while, a person who's big and strong suddenly loses hope. And when whatever the basis for the hope is, doesn't matter. But the moment they lose hope, somehow they just almost literally die on the spot. But this rabbi is encouraging people to keep hope. And one time the rabbi says, where is my son? I'm losing track of my son. And Eli says to him, I'm not sure where he is, but I'm sure you're going to find him sooner. And then later on, he comes across the son way down the road. And the rabbi isn't making it anymore. And he knows what's happened, that the son has somehow kind of left his father behind. And Eli has a little prayer here. My God, Lord of the universe, give me strength never to do what Rabbi Elihu's son has done. Finally, at the end, after a horrendous ride in a train, they get to Buchenwald, and his father is virtually dead. His father says to him, just leave me alone. I'll be all right. Take care of yourself. Go and rest. But he insists that he won't go and rest. But then the sirens wail, there's an alert, everyone scatters, and the guards drive them into various blocks, and he just sinks down in exhaustion, and he sleeps the whole night. And he wakes up the next morning, and he says, I've abandoned my father. And his father is very sick, and he felt terribly ashamed of this moment. And basically now what he's wrestling with in these last moments is how he deals with his father, because every little iota of food may make the difference between life and death. And so the man in charge of the place here says to him, you should keep your food for yourself, don't give it to your father. And he says, at that point when he heard the man say that, I listened to him without interrupting, he was right. I thought in the most secret region of my heart, but I dared not to admit it. It's too late to save your old father, I said to myself. You ought to be having 2 rations of bread, 2 rations of soup. Only a fraction of a second, but I felt guilty. I ran to find a little soup to give to my father. He didn't want it. He wanted only water, and so on. And then a little later, he remarked, I was no better than Rabbi Elihu's son, who deserted his father. And then his father dies, and no prayers said, and so on. And he says, he didn't weep. It pained me that I could not weep, but I had no more tears. And in the depths of my being, in the recesses of my weakened conscience, could I have searched it, I might perhaps have found something like freedom at last. So you hear what he is admitting about himself, that you, if I put it crassly, he was saying, what a relief that my father has finally died. If he would search himself in the depth of his heart. Now the interesting thing, I think, is that at the same time, he himself is saying that about himself, which means that it deeply bothers him. And there, by that little thread of relating that narrative, the inner struggle is going on.
with what it is to keep his humanity. Finally, the story ends, and he says, in the last days, finally, the troops came, and they were also amazingly safe, and the American tanks stood at the gates of Buchenwald, and the first thing they thought about was food. They never thought about revenge, not one thought of revenge. For 3 whole days, not one thought of revenge, nothing but food, and they got food poisoning. And just about, you know, were ill for a long time. And when he finally is able to get up, he looks in the mirror, and he says, a corpse gazed back at me. The look in his eyes, as they stared into mine, has never left me. That last sentence, I think, says to me the ultimate of silence. The book begins where people really don't believe it's going to happen, and then it happens. And it's one long journey into night. And as the night gets deeper and deeper, it's a journey of night into the heart of a person, the heart of a little boy like that. And finally he confronts himself in a mirror, and that's what he sees. Just absolute black, silent night. In many subsequent writings, Elie Wiesel makes it clear to us, you know, that that's where many people were. And that for him personally, as a profoundly human being, the great question was the silence of God. Where was God? Elie Wiesel continues in writing fiction, in which he wants to tell the truth because he feels the story has to be told. And I want to share with you a little bit of an outline of how the stories go, and it's to indicate that he just does not stop there. He writes a whole series of novels. The second one is called Dawn, and now here he tries out what might it be like to be on the other side of the fence, no longer the victim, but the executioner. And the story is in Israel. There is some reprisal going on, and he's with a group of extremists who suddenly ends up where they have taken, I think, a Lebanese or someone captive, and because a Jew has been taken captive, and they say, if you kill that Jew, we're going to kill this other person. And now the speaker is appointed to kill that other person. And the whole novel, it's called Dawn, leads up to the moment where he has to kill that person. And he just can't believe it. You mean I've got to do that? Well, somebody has to do it, and we're going to ask you. You're young, you're 24, you can do it. And the whole story moves through the agony of to that moment, and finally he kills the man, and he comes back upstairs, and they ask him, did you do it? And he answers yes, and in a sense, yes and no. And why no? Because he says, I didn't kill that man, I killed myself. So again, it's a story that ends in the horror of silence. There's another novel called Accident. There's an accident, he's almost killed. And then as he reflects about the accident, he admits to himself that he really, in a sense, wanted to be killed. He got in the way of that car on purpose. And here he's dealing with the same problem, that I cannot live with my past. I just can't handle it. I've got to get away from it. The only way is death. So in a sense, all of these first stories respond to the agony in such a way that there is no response at all. Then a subsequent story really deals with the theme of madness. Here someone goes mad in response. That's perhaps a step out. At least it's a human response, even though it's madness, but it's some kind of a response. Another response in a novel is a person who's a spectator, who stands back and watches the whole thing, watches himself, and never gets engaged with the problem. And then finally, in some of the later novels, a person who has been incredibly scarred by the experience finds one other person with whom he can begin to talk and build a trust relationship and share. And then the implication is that somehow life has regained meaning. Where does God come into this picture? One observer who is to whom I'm indebted for giving you this outline, and I believe it sounds true to everything I understand about Wiesel, and I'm just getting started in him myself, suggests that for Wiesel, our relationship to our fellow man and ourselves involves our relation to God, and our relation to God involves our relation to fellow man. So where is God in all of this? For Elie Wiesel, he goes through quite an agony. God seems to be silent, and there's no simple answer ever, he feels, and the people who've reflected about this feel, for any of us, about God's ready, glib answers. But some responses from God seem to be better than others, like perhaps God's madness would be better than silence. Worst of all would be God just a spectator watching the whole thing happen. But what a phenomenal thing to think that God himself was participant in what happened. And now that little boy hanging there may be something else. That may not just be God dying, but it may be God participating in the agony. I think this may give us a bridge, perhaps, to another figure in the Hebrew Scriptures, the suffering servant, who dies innocently, but dies on behalf of others, and who then, as you know, becomes the model in terms of which Jesus himself sees his death, and in which the New Testament understands the death of Christ. So these stories, I think, give us a different way of looking at Holocaust, namely being in it ourselves. I'd like to pause here a moment and see if any of you want to comment or say anything about it. It's in a sense heartrending, and I saw a few hands, and then I'd like to come back and share one other little thing with you which may make some comparisons and suggest some further food for thought. Yes, thank you. What is your name?
Marty.
Marty, that's right.
The comparison between God's silence and Wiesel's own silence as a son, if he realizes the betrayal of his father, seems very stark and analogous. Does he ever make a direct connection between, I mean, if we say that we know God directly, only directly through other people, then it would seem he might really have a profound insight into that silence if he understood what it meant for him to be silent as he considered taking his father's portion.
It's a beautiful question. I think one of the nice things about it is it's so internalized, you see, because he then turns right around, it was just a thought in his heart, and gives his father the soup, and his father says, I don't want it, I just want some water. But he had to live with the thought, and he has a scrupulous conscience that lives with it, and there is that silence inside.
It's important because it means that it would suggest that the Jewish sadness, remembrance, memory of the event cannot be externalized. The Jewish nation would not then just point away from themselves, but would have to recognize Holocaust within themselves as well. And it seems that would be a different dynamic than the stereotypical one we see of them always feeling or being portrayed as victims, which is not, I don't believe that it's completely accurate, but it's certainly a stereotype we have to deal with.
Yes, and I'd like to say a lot about that, but maybe just briefly, the whole stereotype of them as victims has to be broken down in a number of ways, but in the last analysis, they like to say we were victimized. The question with which they're sometimes taunted, well, why didn't you do something? They did some heroic resistance. Warsaw is one example, and there are a lot of stories. So I think that is worth coming on briefly. But yes, Marty, I think that's profoundly right, and that the suffering is an internal one, and that's why it's so well put, I think, in this novel. Any other comments or observations or questions? Yeah.
I was at a lecture by Wiesel And I left it, and I think everybody else left the same way, with a tremendous guilt complex. He left us feeling, what will you do if there's another Holocaust, you Christians? We left in silence.
Was it a bad feeling? I mean, you know, there are two different kinds of feelings.
Challenge.
Okay, you weren't feeling really angry at him for doing this to you, but it was a terrific challenge. Yeah. I think that is one of the questions that the people who retell the story want to evoke in us. Namely, what are we going to do about it to avoid this in the future? And what can we do now in places where it's happening? What about anti-Semitism? Recently in Salem and in the Portland area and in Eugene, there have been some astounding acts of painting swastikas on synagogues and some real hate literature coming out around. So I think there are things that we need to deal with, and I will just quote you one little quotation which comes out from this Dachau source book which I brought along. Heinrich Heine, the Jewish poet, of Germany back in the last century, said, in German of course, "This was but a prelude. Where books are burnt, human beings will be burnt in the end." 100 or so years before the event. I think what's interesting about that is what is this impulse that leads one to burn a book? And one response we might have for this, to put it very personal, at the personal level, before we get into structural evil, would be to say, there are times when I may feel about someone else, I just as soon wish he weren't around. Okay, the wish to exterminate someone else, I have to recognize. And I think because of the Holocaust experience, I'm much more sensitive to that little impulse in my heart. And to start right with myself, that must go. That's sort of a starting point, because the next thing from the wish, I'll burn the book, you might say, and the next thing, I'll condone the burning of the man, or whatever. The structural evil is much more profound, and I really appreciate the things that are happening here at the village, a lot of areas where you get a chance to deal with that. I know that John Schramm and others, and John Howard Yoder next week, will be dealing with this. Any other comments or questions or observations or corrections?
With the comment you just made, the wish for destruction of other human beings as the goal, how in your own mind do you feel about the reprisals you bring to trial of these war criminals, say at this time, after the 40-year gap?
That's a really good question. A gentleman just came up to me, a pastor, who said that he experienced that personally, where someone came to his church and asked about someone, whether he was one of those persons. And he was a kind 70-year-old man. I understand it's happened in Germany. There's a 75-year-old man, everyone loves him, he's the grandpa of the block, a retired dentist, and suddenly the Jews are marching around. Do you know there's a Nazi in your midst? And there's tremendous resentment. The interesting thing is the German government, I think, has gone along with the opening up of there was a statute of limitations on hunting down the war criminals, and it was about a year ago, and so that continues. This is a very difficult question, and I'm not at all an authority on this, but I'd like to say that the prayer for vengeance and the concern on the part of the Jews for vengeance may have to be looked at from a slightly different light, that it is not just a vendetta, a vindictiveness, but it is a concern for justice. It's a concern for justice.
And future.
Pardon?
And future.
And future, okay.
If there's going to be justice, they won't have future.
For their own future.
And the people.
That may also, in part, explain something which may be very disturbing for Americans and for pacifists and for people sympathetic to the Jews, and that is this incredible Iraqi bombing that they succeeded in some weeks ago, which is another whole topic, but it is equally problematic. How much time do we have?
Not very much.
Not very much. Yes.
At the risk of being heretic, I'm not sure what it is or isn't. When he talked about his being the hope for his father, that's a very heavy thing to carry around. And yet he'd seen it happen in his buddy and father. I all of a sudden fantasized the Jesus of the New Testament and his thinking in terms of hope for perhaps his father. Or if we really are the brothers and sisters, or if we are really the body of Christ, that we carry the hope of God who creates universalistically and creates all people equal. That's an awesome kind of a feeling. You're glad you have a Christ who carries that for you, but to dump too quickly is also to miss the point.
I may have distorted that a little bit. I think his father is living for the boy.
That's what I mean. But that's,
I don't think the novel conveys that as a burden. The burden is more that the father is really having a hard time making it, and then finally he gets sick and burdened in the sense of, the little boy is barely making it himself, and now he has to also take care of his dad.
I thought you were talking about psychologically when the father thought the son had left him, there was no reason to live.
The rabbi's son. No, he never knew about that. You see, they lied to him, and they said, no, he must have gone on ahead.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. There goes the bell. Let me conclude with an observation which I had hoped to develop a little bit more in length. A very beautiful comparison of another book, which is very pertinent to all of this, The Holocaust and the Halakha by a Jewish writer, which describes the piety of Jews who at all costs are going to live within the will of God, is compared to Hiding Place. And at the conclusion of this essay, it's a beautiful review with deeply appreciative of Kortenbaum and very insightful about the relation of the two. He says, the most striking difference between the two works, perhaps, is the final commitment on the part of one to vengeance and justice, and the commitment of the part of the other, Kortenbaum, to forgiveness and to mercy. And this is a Jewish writer writing and saying, we have a hard time as Jews dealing with that mercy because we think only God can give grace, but that is perhaps the most rich point of contrast between the two, that each needs to be affirmed. And I think that's something that gives me a lot of food for further thought. Thank you.